السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيبي إله العالمين أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ألم تر أن الله يعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض؟ ما يكون من نجوى ثلاثة إلا هو رابعهم، ولا خمسة إلا هو سادسهم، ولا أدنى من ذلك ولا أكثر إلا هو معهم أينما كانوا، ثم ينبئهم بما عملوا يوم القيامة، إن الله بكل شيء عليم. صدق الله العلي العظيم. وصلوا على محمد وآل محمد. There's an interesting story in the Quran, and the story is actually described at the outset of chapter number 58, Surah Al-Mujadala. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala begins by proclaiming the following. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. قَدْ سَمِعَ اللَّهُ قَوْلَ الَّتِي تُجَادِلُكَ فِي زَوْجِهَا وَتَشْتَكِي إِلَى اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ يَسْمَعُ تَحَاوُرَكُمَا إِنَّ اللَّهَ سَمِيعٌ بَصِيرٌ. And the translation, God says that at the outset that He hears the words of the woman who came to the Prophet to dispute and to complain. And God says that we hear what she disputes and we hear what she complains of, because God hears the conversation, because God is all hearing, all seeing. In the next few verses, there are a number of legal precedents that are explained, that are elucidated. And in verse number 7, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Do you not see that God knows whatsoever is in the heavens and whatsoever is on earth? There is no secret conversation among three, but that He is their fourth, nor among five, but that He is their sixth, nor less than that, nor more, but that He is with them wheresoever they are." And so these verse tells us that God hears everything. God sees everything, whether you're a group of three engaged in secret conversation, or four, or five, or more, or less. God hears everything, and God sees everything, Muhammad, right? And everybody else. So God hears, and God sees, no matter what the number is, or no matter what is being said, no matter what is being conversed. And the story is interesting because commentators tell us that a woman by the name of Khawla bin Tha'laba, she came to the Prophet. And she said to the Prophet, she complained. She said, "Ya Rasulullah," she said, "you know, my husband, I'm here to complain about my husband because, we spent almost an entire lifetime together. He enjoyed his time with me. But now that I'm old and not as youthful anymore, and not as energetic and productive, he is putting me aside." And so what had happened was that this man, he had said to her the following statement. He had said to her, "Anti alayya ka dhahri ummi," which in Arabic translates to, "You are to me as my mother is to me." So what does he mean by that? In the same way that his own mother is not desirable to him, he's telling her, "You're no longer desirable to me." And this was common for men who were, fed up, or they had no desire towards their wives anymore. They would say the statement, and then they would refrain from seeing their wives. And so she says to him that, "He's worn out my youth. I let him enjoy me, but when I grew older and could no longer bear children, he put me away, saying that I am as his mother's back." And so the next few verses, they describe what actually happens, so that men would not abuse their wives in this way. what actually happens if a man says that statement to his wife. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala replies that for those of you men who say that statement, who commit zihar, and the word for that action is zihar, then you cannot return to your wives unless you do one of three things. Either number one, that you fast two consecutive months, or if he is unable to do that, let him feed 60 poor people. So in that way, God says that what you're doing or what you're saying to your spouses should be taken very seriously. It shouldn't be something where you have all this fun with your wife for the first however many 15, 20, 30, 40 years, and then set her aside when she's no longer physically desirable. And so it's interesting because this is one of those verses that speak about Islamic law. And out of the thousands of verses that are in the Quran, scholars tell us that there are about 500 to 550 which are dedicated to explaining laws, legal rulings. Because Islam is not a very legalistic faith. It's not a very ritual faith. And sometimes, you know, in our day-to-day lives, we tend to overemphasize some of the ritual elements of the faith. And sometimes we forget the core of the faith. Not that there are no ritual elements at all to be upheld, not that there are no rules or regulations at all, because in order for there to be a proper governing system, there have to be some regulations that people adhere to. But it's not all of the Quran. There's a balance between faith, between the core, and between actual ritual and practice. So what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says to the Prophet and to her and indirectly to everyone else is, whatever you are disputing or whatever you are complaining about, God can hear your complaints. And sometimes when we complain, or sometimes when something is holding us back, you know, we tend to assume that God is not listening to us. God is not hearing us. God has maybe abandoned us, or he has forsaken us. And the Prophet, even though he was infallible, and we believe that he was infallible, meaning that he was sinless, however, the Prophet and the rest of the infallibles, it didn't mean that they didn't face any challenges. Their challenge, they also faced challenges. And so one of those challenges, specifically in the life of the Prophet, was that in LA. Can't change it at all. I was supposed to be here today 6:30. I ended up being here 6:45. You can't change it. Now, what I can change is my behavior. I can have a contingency plan and leave 15 minutes earlier or leave 20 minutes earlier. But there are some things that you simply cannot change. So God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, meaning whatever can be changed. God, give me the courage and the strength to change that, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. Knowing that what I can change and what I cannot change. So I want to share this with you. And the author of this book who talks about this concept, he says the following. He says, many people obsess about stupid things that they can't change at the present time. Think about it. The things that you obsess about, where your mind goes when you're alone, usually involves the things that you cannot change at the present time, meaning either indirect control or no control. They swap war stories, and this may sound familiar to some of you. They swap war stories with coworkers and massage one another's hearts about the things they can do nothing about. The people get together when they're in their cubicle farm, when they're in their building, and they talk to each other, and they share war stories about things that they can't change. But that just weakens their ability to make things happen on the issues and concerns that they can do something about. Again, their past holds their future hostage. Most of the time when we begin to drift into worry about the things that we cannot change, you're actually taking away from your ability and your energy that should be used towards the thing that you can change in your life. And then he says the following. He says, they then fall into the trap of codependency. What's codependency? Codependency is when you depend, in general terms, it's when you depend on someone else for something. So your fulfillment and your happiness depends on someone else's behavior to perform or not to perform. That's called codependency. He talks about codependency in the introduction of the book, and he says, if you're reading this book and thinking, man, this person that I know seriously needs to read this book, he says, that's codependency. Because now you're thinking about another person's challenges and problems, and you stop thinking about your own challenges and problems. So people, then, when you give so much energy to things that you're complaining about and things that you cannot control, you become codependent on somebody else's behavior. And that spawns what, again, I call, he says, the five metastasizing emotional cancers. There's emotional cancers, not just physical cancers. Criticizing, there are five of them. Criticizing, complaining, comparing, competing, and contending. Think about those for a little bit. I'll repeat them again. Criticizing, complaining, comparing, competing, and contending. Contending is like, they say when two fighters get in the cage or they get in the ring, they're contending for the title. So there's competition. Contending means that it's a win-lose situation. Both boxers can't win. One of them has to pummel the other to a bloody pulp, or it's not so much about boxing now, it's mixed martial arts, or whatever it is. One of them has to win in order for the other to lose. And sometimes it's a draw, or sometimes it's what they call no contest. So it's, they can't tell who's the winner and who's the loser for whatever reason. So criticizing, complaining, comparing, competing, and contending. People who don't have their own deep internal act together seek their security from sources outside themselves. When we don't have our own act together, when we're insecure on the inside, we're always seeking security on the outside. We're waiting for somebody else to change in order for us to feel secure about ourselves. We're waiting for someone else to behave or act in a certain way for us to feel good about ourselves. And that is an emotional that's an emotional cancer. Because they're codependent with their environment, they engage in these destructive, cancerous behaviors. So just a little something that I wanted to share. Now, I'm not saying that here in the verse where God is describing this woman, because clearly he says she disputes with you concerning her husband, but complains to God. Her complaint, وَتَشْتَكِي إِلَى اللَّهِ. So her first complaint is to God, and that's why she went to the messenger of God. But it's not that you never ever complain. Most of us are complaining to the wrong people. Most of us are, we spend our time and our energy complaining to people who can't really make a difference in our life. And if you are to complain, well, the Quran teaches us in a number of places. Here it says, تَشْتَكِي إِلَى اللَّهِ, meaning that as long as she is complaining to God, then God is listening to her. In the story of the Prophet Yusuf, chapter number 12, what does he say? He says, إِنَّمَا أَشْكُو بَثِّي وَحُزْنِي إِلَى اللَّهِ. None of you guys, he says, none of you guys can do anything for me. Only God can do something for me. Only God can change my situation. So those are some of those, what he refers to as the cancerous behaviors. So when she comes to the Prophet and she complains, God then reveals the verse. That for those of you who commit that act, for those of you who make that statement to their wives, well then you cannot approach your wives until you do the following. Either you fast, or you free a slave, or you feed 64 people. And so narrations tell us that this couple, they were not in a position to do any of that. So they could not feed 64 people from what they had. They could not free a slave. I mean, that meant that they had to purchase a slave and free him. That was a major undertaking within themselves and within itself, and they were an older couple. And they could not fast, or he could not fast, rather, for 60 consecutive days, because that would have taken a toll on him physically as well. So in that moment, the Prophet said, and here it's interesting because here you see the model for prophetic leadership. See, what the Prophet did was that he found a solution to a challenge. He found a solution to a problem. And that attitude and that behavior comes from the prophetic model of leadership. What does that mean? Most people in their life, they'll find challenges instead of finding solutions. It's easy to find a challenge. It's easy to find a problem. It's easy to find an issue. It's easy to find what's wrong with something. It's easy to find what's wrong with someone. Why? Because if you face a challenge or a problem or an issue, or if you identify that in someone, the next step after that would be, well, it's not my problem anymore. In order for you to say it's not my problem anymore, you have to find a challenge. What leaders do is they find solutions to challenges. And that's why it's important that whenever you're stuck in a challenge, when you're facing an issue, that you talk to a leader, meaning talk to someone that you trust, someone that is going to give you vision or someone that is going to give you clarity so that you can know what's going on. So the Prophet said, okay, well, the final solution is if you can come up with half of the food in order to give the poor people, I'll match you. I'll give you the other half. And so he told them, just come up with enough dates to feed 30 people. And that's exactly what they did, because you know, during those days especially, dates were considered considered a primary source of food, because they were loaded with sugar and potassium and all that good stuff. And so he told them, as long as you can come up with enough for 30 people, then I'll match you. I'll give 30. So the Prophet didn't want to close the door completely. He wanted to offer a solution, and that was from his, prophetic leadership example. So, moving along that all builds up to verse number 7, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, haven't you considered that your maker, your creator, understands what's going on? He knows what's going on and understands what's going on in your life? That there's never a case where three people come to converse secretly that he doesn't know about, or four people come to converse secretly and he is not the fifth, or less than that, or more than that? Have you not considered that? And commentators tell us the following. It's very interesting. They say that this was revealed in regards to those who were plotting against the Prophet. Because history tells us, and even the Quran tells us, that when the Prophet arrived in Medina, That's where different challenges. So there were specific set of challenges in Mecca, but then there was a specific set of challenges in Medina as well. And from those challenges in Medina is that there were people that were plotting against him. People that were plotting against, plotting to overthrow him and create confusion and disruption. And so in a way, God is telling the Prophet, he says, don't you realize that whatever they're plotting, whether they're doing it publicly or whether they're doing it privately, whether it's a group of three people or four people or five people or more than that or less than that, God knows what's happening. God knows what is going on. He knows what's in their hearts. He knows what they're planning. He knows what they're plotting. And it's really, you know, when I look at it, it's really an indirect message to us, because sometimes you think, and I know this is probably more prevalent in Middle Eastern communities, where there's the assumption that someone's always out to get us. Someone's out to do us evil. Someone's out to do us harm. Someone's out to block our success and stand in our way. And what God is telling the prophet, that look, don't worry and don't spend all that emotional energy. Don't spend all that time thinking about the people that wish bad for you, that wish evil for you. Because no matter what they come up with, what they plot, what they try to do in order to divert you from your path or your success, they're not going to be successful, because we're there watching. We're there and we have your back. You know, one of the primary examples of that, we're told, and most of you are familiar with the story, that when the Prophet decided to migrate from Mecca to Medina, and the Quraysh got together, and each one of them had one of the leaders, each one of the leaders or representatives of the various tribes that were included in that coalition, they had an idea. So one person said, well, we'll just imprison him. We'll imprison him. I mean, what's he going to do about it? And then they said to him, well, no, we can't imprison him, because he has a tribe. He has family. They'll come and break him out. One of them said, well, you know, we will just exile him. And then they said, well, no, we can't exile him, because if we send him out into the desert, obviously he's charismatic. Obviously he's influential. He'll just gain supporters out there and he'll come back and he'll take over Mecca. And so the final decision that they arrived at was that let's assassinate him, but it can't be one of us. It has to be a group decision. And it has to be a group of assassins that go in. Why? Because if it's one of us from one tribe, well, his family, they're going to want retaliation. And they're allowed retaliation. But if it's all of us and we all go in, then they can't accept retaliation. We'll pay them blood money, and we'll gladly pay them the diyah. We'll gladly pay them the blood money. And as much as they plotted, as much as they calculated, as much as they tried to figure out what to do, how to do it, down to the small details, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He says in the Quran, وَيَمْكُرُونَ وَيَمْكُرُ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ, that they calculate and they deceive, but God, and they plan for deceit, but God also calculates as well. And so sometimes we try to calculate our life. Sometimes we try to figure out every single detail, and it can be very overwhelming. Or sometimes we spend, as I mentioned, a lot of energy, mental and emotional energy, thinking, well, if this person retaliates to me in this way, if this person does evil to me in this way, this is how I'm going to give it back to them. Sometimes if you've noticed, we create these situations in our mind with people that don't exist at all. And a lot of that comes from our own insecurity. Sometimes we get in arguments with people just in our minds, and that argument never really takes place. And a lot of that comes from codependency. It comes from our own insecurities. So understanding that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows what's going on. He hears what's going on. Every time we have a complaint, every time we have a criticism, every time something like that is going on within our hearts, God is with us. God understands us. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to grant us serenity and security. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow us to change that which we can change, and patience with those things that we cannot change. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us and our families, and to include all of those who are in need of our dua in our dua. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. اللهم اغفر للمؤمنين والمؤمنات والمسلمين والمسلمات الأحياء منهم والأموات تابع بيننا وبينهم بالخيرات إنك مجيب الدعوات إنك قاضي الحاجات إنك على كل شيء قدير برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين